Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 19th, 2024, we're delighted to host a litigation update on several cases relating to the scope of the free speech rights of K-12 students. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we will keep our introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more about any of our speakers, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Casey Maddox, who currently serves as Vice President for Legal Strategy at Stand Together and is a senior advisor at Americans for Prosperity. Prior to joining Stand Together and AFP, his legal career focused on defending the First Amendment rights of students, faculty, healthcare workers, and religious organizations. And I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. One last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Maddox, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks, Shayla. And thanks to the Federalist Society for providing this platform, allowing us to be able to have this, this conversation about three very interesting free speech cases affecting the free speech rights of K-12 students. All of which are pending or have just cleared a court of appeals, as you'll hear. So it's a great opportunity to just get connected what these cases are and the potential implications of them. So free speech rights or lack thereof of K-12 students has always been a pretty unique area in First Amendment law. Cases like Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District back 60 years ago, established that students don't leave their First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse gate. But what exactly does that mean? When are the free speech rights of students, particularly K-12 students, coextensive with those of adults in the First Amendment area? And what restrictions can be placed on them? Later decisions from the Supreme Court have allowed limiting offensive or inappropriate speech for middle school students, elementary school students. And so those cases seem to create a bit of a difference between free speech rights even of college students and K-12 students. And these three cases, I think, are great both examples of that and potential opportunities to get some needed clarity in this area of the law. So the three cases are, and you'll note that all three of these cases, the plaintiffs in the cases are all using initials because they're, of course, minors. So DA versus Tri-County Area Schools, you'll hear about this case. This is the case where a Michigan student was forbidden from wearing a Let's Go Brandon sweatshirt. This is a fire case. LM versus Town of Middleboro, a Massachusetts school that forbade students, a student from wearing a There Are Only Two Genders shirt. This is, of course, an ADF case. And then BB versus Capistrano Unified School District. It's a California school that punished a first grade student over a drawing that included the statement, "All Lives Matter." So our three panelists to discuss the cases that they are working on here are Caleb Trotter. Caleb is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, where he litigates on behalf of individuals and small businesses fighting for their constitutional rights to free speech, economic liberty, and equal protection under the law. Caleb's practice at PLF is primarily focused on free speech rights that allow people to pursue the profession of their choice and in the manner that they see fit. Prior to PLF, Caleb clerked for the Institute for Justice. He attended law school at Loyola University in New Orleans. And unfortunately, is a Texas Rangers fan. Connor Fitzpatrick is the supervising senior attorney for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, where he litigates to defend the First Amendment freedoms in courts at all levels, state and federal. Connor comes to FIRE by way of Detroit, Michigan, where he was a principal at Miller Canfield, Paddock and Stone. Before joining FIRE, he taught First Amendment law as an adjunct professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. When not thinking about the First Amendment, Connor enjoys reading, running, and eating sushi. And he says that he avidly supports Detroit sports teams, but rarely enjoys it. And then Tyson Langhofer serves as senior counsel and director for the Center for Academic Freedom with Alliance Defending Freedom. Tyson represents students and faculties at public high schools and colleges in defending their First Amendment rights before joining ADF. Tyson was a partner with Stinson LLP, where he worked as a commercial litigation attorney from 2000 until he joined ADF in 2015. So, gentlemen, let's talk about your three cases, and we'll begin sort of going across the country, left to right, beginning with Caleb and discussing your case, and then we'll kind of move through these three. We'll, of course, take some, I'll offer a couple of questions just for those who are listening. We'll begin with a couple of questions there, but by all means, please put your questions in the Q&A function, because we want to get to as many of those as we possibly can. So, Caleb, floor is yours.
Thank you, Casey. So, as Casey said, our case is BB v. Capistrano Unified School District. Capistrano is in Orange County in Southern California, right along the coast. So the facts of this case, I think most everyone can agree, are quite egregious and outrageous. So our client, BB, she was in first grade. At one point in the school year, the teacher was teaching a unit on Martin Luther King Jr. As a part of that unit, they were going over a book. And within this book, the students were introduced to the concept of Black Lives Matter. In addition to that, there was a poster that was displayed in a very prominent room that most all the students passed through every day, that had a poster that had, you know, the phrase Black Lives Matter and also a clenched fist on it. So these are topics that were introduced by the school itself to very young elementary school students. As a part of this, these lessons, our client BB was essentially made to feel bad for her classmates of color. And because of that, and in the innocence of a first grader's mind, she decided to, what else but to draw a picture to try and, you know, make her friend feel welcome and included in the school. So to do that, she wrote the phrase Black Lives Matter in marker. Because she's in first grade, she misspelled matter. She only had one T. Below that, she wrote any life. And then below that, she made four little ovals in various colors that were to represent herself, her classmate of color, and then two other classmates that were friends. And then the picture was supposed to depict them all holding hands. Just a very friendly gesture. She gave this drawing to her classmate, who thanked her, put it in her backpack, and, you know, went on home. It was no big deal. Later that evening, the mother of the student who received the drawing was going through her daughter's backpack, found it, and was concerned that, you know, why is her daughter receiving this picture? Is she being singled out for her race? She wasn't aware that Black Lives Matter was being taught in school. So reasonably, and I think naturally, she inquired with the school principal as to, you know, what's going on. Why is my daughter getting this picture? The principal, you know, looked further. Apparently, he didn't even necessarily know that Black Lives Matter was being taught in his own class. I mean, that's somewhat of a dispute. But upon looking into it, he learned the facts and told the family that, you know, this was, you know, just an innocent drawing. They agreed that, yes, BB was innocent and trying to make their daughter feel welcome. They made very clear that they did not want her to be punished for this drawing because of the innocence. And just kind of left it at that. Unfortunately, the principal then took it upon himself to inform BB that her inclusion of the phrase any life was, quote, racist and inappropriate, end quote, told her that she needed to apologize to her classmate, told her she could no longer draw and give pictures to her classmates anymore. That's pretty extreme for first graders. And then when she went back to class, her teachers told her she had to sit out of recess for 2 weeks. Now, just the punishment of this is extreme enough, but worse still, BB's parents didn't even find out about this for about a year late, until about a year later, when another parent just mentioned it in passing, assuming that they were aware of this. So of course, Bibi's parents were very upset. They wanted an explanation. They wanted answers. Unfortunately, the response from the principal was basically a denial that any of it had ever happened. That kind of continued and led to some internal complaint procedures within the school and the school district. Really, all the parents wanted at that point was an apology for what had happened. And that wasn't forthcoming. And so that eventually led to litigation. Several claims in the case, but the only two that are relevant for today's purposes are kind of a core complaint, just that this punishment for a drawing violated Bibi's First Amendment rights. And then related to that, the punishment was impermissible retaliation in response to her exercising her First Amendment rights. So this case was filed a little over a year or so ago. It went through discovery and got to summary judgment. And the district court in the U.S. Central District for California, the judge ruled in favor of the school, basically saying that Bibi had no First Amendment rights because of her age, essentially saying that very young elementary school students just don't have First Amendment rights. And in addition to that, there were several dismissive lines in his opinion that are troublesome in their own right. But essentially just looking at this as, what's the problem here? What do you expect school administrators to do? They've got all these decisions to make on any given day. Since this wasn't really a big deal, nope, it shouldn't even really be in court. And they're very young. Nothing to see here was essentially the district court's view of this. Now, of course, as Casey mentioned, the primary Supreme Court case relevant here is the Tinker v. Des Moines case. And interestingly, that case essentially presented two circumstances where school administrators can restrict student speech rights. One is in an effort to avoid and prevent substantial disruption in the school. In our case, there's no evidence of that being present or really a concern at all, since this drawn in class, given to the student, taken home. The evidence in this case shows that when Bibi apologized to her classmate, neither of them knew why she was apologizing, because they didn't understand that there was a problem, that anyone had done anything wrong, and no one had bothered to explain it to her either, other than the principal telling her that she was racist and inappropriate for this drawing. So it's troublesome that even if we assume that there was a problem with any life, and I'm of course not making that assumption, there was a real lost opportunity for it to be a learning moment here. So there's all that to say, there's no evidence that there was any disruption in school. So that leaves us with this second part of the Tinker case, which there are not very many cases that raise this issue at all. And that is the right of students to be let alone in school, basically just to be able to learn and go about their day. And the district court troublingly said that, this phrase, any life on the drawing, it looks an awful lot like All Lives Matter, which in 2021, when these events happened, was of course on the tail end of the summer of 2020 with the major Black Lives movement across the country. Evidence that phrase, All Lives Matter, can be a problem, can be controversial, he cites a New York Times article just basically showing that, yes, this is controversial in the adult context, and said, well, clearly any life must have meant the same thing. And so she was being targeted for her race by inclusion of this phrase. Now that's troubling. We've appealed this case because of the issues of the judge dismissing young elementary school's First Amendment rights. Also, just this importation of this controversial idea that the school itself introduced to the school, and where the case is now in the Ninth Circuit. A briefing is underway. I expect that it'll be argued sometime next year, maybe spring or summer. But basically what we're looking to do with this case is confirm that young elementary school students retain First Amendment rights. I mean, after all, the 1943 Supreme Court case of Barnett v. West Virginia, where students were required to recite the Pledge of Allegiance and salute the American flag. These were 7- and 8-year-old students, and the Supreme Court held that, yes, of course, Even students that young retain First Amendment rights, cannot be compelled to recite the pledge and salute the flag. Our position is nothing in First Amendment law has changed in that nearly 80 years. Then we, of course, have the Tinker case. And so we think this case presents a real opportunity just to, you know, confirm that young elementary school students do possess First Amendment rights, but also to provide real clarity around this Tinker interference with the rights of others prong. And because of the evidence in this case of the innocence of the students, the innocent motives, the welcoming motives here, where we're confident that the Ninth Circuit will review this case and issue a ruling that is much more respective of the First Amendment rights as we feel Supreme Court precedent commands.
Thank you, Caleb. Let's go to Connor.
Sure. Thank you, Casey. So we represent two West Michigan students who wore Let's Go Brandon hoodies to their middle school. Now one is in high school and the other is still in middle school. Now, for those of you who don't spend near as much time on Twitter as I do, first of all, congratulations. And second of all, you should know that Let's Go Brandon has sort of become a cultural code for the phrase F Joe Biden. It began at a NASCAR race when the crowd was chanting F Joe Biden, and the TV commentators sort of interpreted that for the listening audience as, oh, they're chanting Let's Go Brandon because the winner of the NASCAR race was Brandon Brown. So Let's Go Brandon quickly became this political slogan that spread like wildfire. Within months, multiple members of Congress had used it on the House floor during floor speeches opposing policy proposals from the Biden administration. It was omnipresent on social media, on terrestrial radio, on broadcast TV. It was very, very hard to avoid the slogan for a good few months. So these two kids get Let's Go Brandon hoodies for Christmas, and they wear them to their middle school over a period of about 3 or 4 months in early 2022. And what was very helpful that Caleb mentioned is the Tinker standard, where in school speech cases, we're often looking for evidence of disruption or substantial disruption of students expressing themselves in some way to disrupt the orderly functioning of class and the ordinary functioning of school. And nothing like that happened here. In fact, nobody cared. They wore these sweatshirts for 3 or 4 months, and the only ones that ever noticed it were the school assistant principal and one of their English teachers. And they were instructed to remove the hoodies, which they complied. They're good students. They both have a great disciplinary record. But they felt that they shouldn't have to give up their free speech rights at the schoolhouse gate, like Casey was mentioning earlier. So we were lucky enough to get in touch with them. And after the school district refused to back down in response to a demand letter, we filed suit. We filed suit to protect the right of these two students and all West Michigan students to peacefully make their political views known in school. Now, obviously, the big issue in this case actually comes down to another Supreme Court decision that came after Tinker called Bethel v. Frazier. Bethel v. Frazier involved a student who gave a sexual innuendo-laden speech to a student council election speech at a school assembly. And the Supreme Court held in the 80s that schools have an interest in prohibiting explicit sexual innuendo, profanity, obscenity, and vulgarity. And in the 3 decades since Frazier, there hasn't been a lot of additional guidance as to what profanity, obscenity, and vulgarity means. It's very easy to get to a Justice Potter Stewart place of I know it when I see it, but this case very much gives us an example of perhaps that's not true. So our position in this case was and remains that different words mean different things. The word heck does not mean the same as hell. People say shoot instead of its other brethren that starts with an S for the same reason that people say frick instead of its brethren, and so on and so forth. So we readily concede that kids can't drop F-bombs at school. Under Bethel, that seems to be pretty clear. But these kids didn't do that. What they did is, like the members of Congress did during their floor speeches, they used an intentionally sanitized version of a popular political phrase in order to peacefully make their views known at school. And in our view, that's squarely protected by the First Amendment. And one of the reasons for that is from Tinker, which is that our schools exist to prepare students for life as an American citizen. And life as an American citizen means that people may occasionally disagree with you. Your neighbors and your coworkers and your friends may occasionally have different views and even express themselves in a different way than you do. And trying to encase kids in a bubble until they turn 18 and then expecting them to be rounded American citizens ready for our pluralistic democracy is simply not realistic. So right now we're up at the Sixth Circuit. Unfortunately, the district court ruled against us. The district court took what might be called a very originalist view of schools' authority over student speech, believing that sort of the norm is that schools have the ability to tell students what they are and aren't allowed to wear, and First Amendment rights are the exception, when in fact the law is the other way around. So we're disappointed with that ruling, but we are currently in the Sixth Circuit appealing it.
Thanks, Connor. And Tyson.
All right. Thanks, Casey. So we represent LM. At the time, he was a seventh grader in the town of Middleborough, Massachusetts. And as with many public schools nowadays, the public schools regularly engaged in speech involving or promoting certain LGBT rights. And so they had a Pride Week where they would encourage students to wear their pride gear in support of the LGBT movement. And they had other posters throughout the hallways that they would have teachers posting rainbow flags and expressing, you know, support of LGBT students, and also, you know, expressing specifically support related to issues of gender identity and the fact that gender could be a spectrum and that gender is determined by feelings rather than sex, and that's the important part of somebody's identity. So LM had been in this school district from the very beginning of his schooling, and he saw that this message was being promoted, and he had a different opinion, and he wanted to express this different opinion. And so he, you know, peacefully decided to wear this shirt that said there are only two genders. He wore that to school. On the bus on the way to school, there was no disruption, no problems. In fact, a couple of the students said, the only comments were, "I like your shirt, where can I get one?" He got to school, and again, no problems. But his first hour kind of homeroom teacher saw the shirt and was concerned that other students may not like the shirt. So she called the principal. The principal went and pulled LM out of class, which was the PE class he was initially in, and said, "You can't wear this shirt." And LM objected and said, "Well, I don't understand why." So they went to the principal's office, had a discussion, and basically she gave him two options: either remove the shirt or you'll need to go home for the day. So he opted to remove the shirt and go home. So afterwards, a couple weeks later, LM's father reached out to the principal and said, "Hey, I'm just wondering, why did you require my son to remove his shirt?" And they wrote back and cited a policy in their student handbook. And the policy had a number of provisions regarding certain clothing and appropriate clothing and so forth. But there was two specific provisions that are relevant here. One said that you can't wear any clothing that states, implies, or depicts hate speech or imagery that targets groups based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious affiliation, or any other classification. They also had one that said that any other apparel that the administration determines to be unacceptable to our community standards will not be allowed. And they said that this shirt that said there are only two genders was hate speech, and that it targeted certain student groups based upon their gender identity. So LM and his family didn't agree with this decision, and so they retained the Massachusetts Family Institute to write a letter. And they wrote a letter to the school and said that LM will be wearing this shirt again on May 5th, which was a couple weeks later. The school wrote back and said, "You can't wear that. We reiterate our position that this is a violation of policy." So the next day, LM wore a shirt, the same shirt, but he taped over only two, And it's so it, the shirt read, "There are censored genders." But apparently, because the school knew that he was going to be coming, they actually sent the vice principal to the bus stop to meet LM at the bus. LM wasn't riding the bus that day, so he got to school, walked in. They immediately found him, told him to go to the principal's office, and told him to remove the shirt. This time he did remove the shirt because, as with these other students we were talking about, he's a good student. He's an honor student. He had never had been disciplined before. He had a fine disciplinary record and didn't want to miss another day of school. So he removed the shirt. And so the interesting part of this, before we get into the litigation, that this policy that the school actually, you know, cited regarding hate group is in the student handbook. And this same student handbook, interestingly, actually contains two provisions which actually support the position that LM was taking. And he said that it actually says that education must be fully open and available to members of both sexes. And that sexual harassment refers to written materials or pictures derogatory to either gender. It's clearly a declaring that there is a sex binary, which is the position supported by LM. But they utilize that same policy to essentially say that it, by expressing that opinion, that there are only two sexes, that he targeted these students and could not wear the shirt. So we filed a lawsuit along with Massachusetts Family Institute challenging this policy. Unfortunately, at the district court denied our motion for temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction. As both Connor and Caleb indicated, they analyzed the claims under the Tinker standard. And there are the two provisions that Tinker says you can regulate speech if it materially and substantially interferes with the requirements of appropriate discipline in the operation of the school, or it collides with the rights of others. As both Caleb and Connor have indicated, almost all of the cases that analyze this do it under the material and substantial disruption standard, because that's typically what schools claim. In this case, there was no evidence of any substantial disruption. In fact, they had removed LM from class within an hour of both of these things happening, and there was no evidence that any disruption had actually occurred. As a result, the school argued, well, it wasn't a material substantial disruption, but it collided with the rights of others. That this is a standard that has rarely been applied, especially in the context of a passive shirt or passive message on a shirt. But the district court in this case, unfortunately, ruled for the school and essentially ruled that the school administrators were well within their discretion to conclude that the message displayed may communicate that only two gender identities, male and female, are valid, and that any others are valid, are invalid, or non-existent. And because of that, they say that students who identify differently have a right to attend school without being confronted by messages attacking their identity. And so that was an invasion, according to the district court, of the rights of other students to a safe and secure educational environment. We appealed that ruling to the First Circuit, and the First Circuit looked at it and they said, well, you know, there really is some uncertainty as to when the rights of others limitations applies to a passive and silent expression that doesn't target any specific student or students, but assertedly demeans a personal characteristic like race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation that other students at the school share. So the First Circuit acknowledged that when you're dealing with this invasion of the rights of others, it's usually talking about some type of physically coercive conduct, where in one case, students were passing out buttons and they were running around putting them on students, like forcing them to adopt this and really creating a disruption. That was an invasion of the rights of others. But here, there was no physically coercive conduct, and there was no aggressive speech. There was no disruptive action or threats or acts of violence. So the First Circuit said, you know, there really isn't an invasion of the rights of others as it pertains to what Tinker was really referring to here. So they decided to analyze it under the substantial disruption standard. But unfortunately for the school district, there is no substantial disruption. There was no disruption at all. In fact, because they removed LM from the class before anything happened. So the First Circuit adopted essentially a completely new standard, different from Tinker, when it talks about the evidence that's necessary to demonstrate that there was a material and substantial disruption. And the new standard adopted by the First Circuit to affirm the district court's decision that that the school did not violate LM's rights is twofold. They said that school officials can bar passive and silently expressed messages by students at school, even if that message doesn't target a specific student, if the expression is reasonably interpreted to demean a personal characteristic such as race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation, because the common understanding of such characteristics are they're unalterable and deeply rooted. And so that strikes, that demeans the person at the core of this person's being. So number one, if the expression is interpreted to demean a personal characteristic of race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation, and two, the demeaning message is reasonably forecast to, quote, poison the educational atmosphere due to its serious negative psychological impact on students with that characteristic. So they analyzed this standard and they said that the phrase, there are only two genders, does in fact satisfy that standard, because they said it was targeting a specific group of kids, and that the message was demeaning and that it was likely to poison the educational atmosphere. As a result, they upheld the punishment of LM and dismissed our claims that the policy in fact violated LM's rights of speech. And this is a really concerning, as with the other two cases that Connor and Caleb are working on, this is a really concerning standard, right? Because one of the core components, or there's really two core components of First Amendment jurisprudence. One, the heckler's veto, which says that other people, the fact that they disagree with yours, that your opinion, the government can't punish you or shut down your speech just because other people disagree. And in fact, a lot of the cases that the First Circuit relied upon are cases that reaffirm this, that say, look, students don't have a right to be sheltered from opinions they disagree with. And so you have that heckler's veto, which really is what is being allowed here in these cases. But you also have the notion of viewpoint neutrality. And there is no dispute that anyone that objected to LM's message was doing so based on his viewpoint. And in fact, the school was promoting the exact opposite viewpoint on a regular basis and encouraging students to express their support of that viewpoint. But if you express an opposite one, you're going to be punished or told you have to go home. So that's a very concerning standard, and it's a very subjective standard, which grants government officials the right to determine what types of political viewpoints can be expressed passively without any disruption in public schools. And it's why this case, along with the cases that Connor and Caleb are working on, are really, really important, because the Supreme Court has noted that one of the primary goals of public schools is to promote an understanding of the First Amendment and our constitutional rights and teach kids how to live in a community with people who have very different opinions on very different topics. So this case, we are going to be appealing that to the Supreme Court, and our petition is due on October 9th, and we'll be filing it then.
Great. All right. Well, thank you, Tyson. This is very helpful. Let's would encourage people again to put your questions in the Q&A function. And we will try to get to as many of those as we can. While you do that, I'm going to kick off with perhaps just a couple of questions to kind of maybe draw out some of the connections between these cases. To what degree? Well, let me ask it this way: should students' First Amendment rights? Let's say if you were able to write the case law the way you think it ought to be. Should students' First Amendment rights be coextensive with that of adults? And is there a difference between, second semester senior and your first semester kindergarten student? Is there a difference between the way that the First Amendment should apply in those different contexts? I'll toss that out there for whoever wants to jump in first.
I'll take it.
Sure.
So in terms of whether the First Amendment rights of students should be completely coextensive with adults, I'm not sure too many would go that far. And one of the reasons is that schools still serve a function. So there are types of First Amendment expression that would be absolutely protected by adults or even for kids outside the school context that are still not appropriate in a school. So, for example, you can't get up during math class and start marching around holding a protest placard. That disrupts math class. It's inconsistent with the mission of the school. And just because you want to make a point about whatever during math class doesn't mean that you can leave your seat and disrupt lessons. Now, the standard that I think is actually quite helpful in sort of having a little bit of an analogy here is First Amendment rights in the prison context. So Bart Simpson may have been onto something when he said this school is like a prison. In prisons, you retain your First Amendment rights that aren't inconsistent with your status as a prisoner. So too in school, I think a fair undercurrent of the law is students retain all of their First Amendment rights in school unless it's inconsistent with the purpose of a school, unless it substantially disrupts what the school is there to do. But like in Tinker, when Mary Beth Tinker and the others wore a black armband to protest the Vietnam War, they were engaging in passive political expression. They weren't disrupting the school day. They were going about their lessons, and they just wanted to make their views known on a major issue of national concern, like every other American citizen. And so long as what students are doing is not inconsistent with the school's purpose, which is to educate and hold classes and teach, then they retain their First Amendment rights.
So I'll just weigh in quickly. I agree with Connor in general with what he's saying, that, you know, there are clearly unique circumstances that schools are in, and they have a unique purpose, and that's to educate. And it's not designed for students to stand up randomly and spout their political opinions. At the same time, there's a lot of First Amendment precedents that apply in the forum context, which could be applied here, such as reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. Those reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions could be utilized to apply a unique forum of the first of the public school context and say, look, in class, you're not allowed to randomly get up and spout those opinions, but you might be able to wear a shirt, you know, in the hallways. And again, that's sort of consistent with what Connor's talking about, that the unique circumstances or the unique setting of a public school, you can adopt the First Amendment principles there. But I do think that there are a couple principles that were violated by all three of these cases that are really important. That's the viewpoint neutrality and the heckler's veto. And it's very difficult to maintain the robust First Amendment protections if we allow hecklers or individuals that disagree to simply shut down other viewpoints. And if you allow the government officials the discretion to determine which viewpoints allowed and which viewpoints not.
And I'd just quickly add, Casey, to your aspect of the age question, since our case, of course, involves a first grader. I don't think anyone's saying or arguing that first graders should be treated the same way as a 12th grader. I think within the confines of the Tinker analysis, the framework is already there that what's disruptive in 12th grade might not be disruptive in first grade or vice versa, well, probably most likely vice versa, as well as what is interfering with the rights of a first grader will be very different from what it would be with a 12th grader. And so I think that viewing those contexts in a case-by-case basis, that framework already exists, and I think that's not going to be difficult for rational administrators to administer. So I think we already have the framework we need to analyze those questions, no matter what the age of the students is.
I'm going to turn to some of the questions. We got a number of questions that have been put in the Q&A. I want to turn to some of those. One here from an anonymous person, which I respect because I'm a big fan of anonymous speech, is asking, how do parental rights enter the picture here? If you have parents of other students who may not want their student to see certain content, how do you think about the rights of other parents, or the at least maybe competing interest of other parents to say, well, we don't want those students engaging in that kind of behavior at the school, because that is communicating messages to my kid that I don't want my kid to receive, right? So how do we think about that in this context?
I'll weigh in real quick. I mean, I think it obviously depends on what speech it is. Is this the school speech, the government speech, or is this individual student speech? And I think there's a different standard. Obviously, there's a lot of states that regulate and essentially give parents certain rights to know information, like what types of curriculum is being taught at school. And there's, you know, FERPA, which requires that parents be given access to their educational records of their children. So all that stuff, you know, if it relates to government speech, then parents have certain rights to know that information. And they also have certain rights to opt out in certain states from certain curriculum, such as sex ed, things like that. I don't think that I'm not aware of, and maybe Connor and Caleb have a different take, but I'm not aware of any rights that parents would have to say, I have a right to shield my student from anything that another student would say, other than to say, you don't have to send them to public school. You can homeschool them or you can go to private school, but you don't have a right to shield them from third parties' opinions that are not government officials who are expressing those opinions.
Yeah, I would agree. Even in the limited case law there is on the interference with rights of others prong under Tinker, the cases are very clear that simple taking offense to something that's said is not enough. There needs to be other substantive evidence of a real interference rising to a disruptive level. I think basically harassment and tortious interference type of activities are what several of the cases say the level has to rise to. And I think that's plainly obvious in all three of our cases that is clearly not present.
I think the other challenge here, it seems to me, is that you're not even the parent in this hypothetical wouldn't just be saying, I have a right for my student not to see this information. They'd be saying, I have a right to demand that government officials shield my student from this information. Have the government intervene on behalf of one parent against another student, I think is particularly one of the challenging pieces. And that kind of distinguishes it, I think, Tyson, as you were saying, from, you know, the school itself communicating a message. There may be, you know, places where a parent has an ability to say, I don't want my child taught this information or shown these pictures or anything like that, right? There may be circumstances there where that works, but that's the school itself communicating. We have a couple of questions on this point, and I'm going to sort of ask this kind of broadly because we haven't mentioned this case yet. You have the cursing cheerleader case, the Mahanoy case that the Supreme Court decided recently. So I'm going to sort of open it up with a pretty broad question. It's basically just what are the implications of that case for each of these three cases? And if one of you wants to jump in and provide a bit of a background on the Mahanoy case, Connor, I see you put your hand up. So.
Sure. I'll take Mahanoy. And part of it is I have a very similar case to Mahanoy that I'm currently litigating in the Eastern District of Tennessee. So for those of you who aren't First Amendment nerds like the rest of us, first of all, we always welcome more to the team. But second, so Mahanoy was a Supreme Court case a couple of years ago that involved a high school student who was upset at not making the varsity cheerleading team and only making the JV team, going home and ranting on social media. And she posted on her Snapchat the phrase F cheer, though she completed the word that began with the F. And she also complained that the cheerleading coach was giving preferential treatment to others. And in retaliation for that, the school suspended her from extracurricular activities for a year. And the Supreme Court overturned it. The Supreme Court said that this student was speaking on her own time, away from school, and her communications did not substantially disrupt the school environment. And what Mahanoy really is bringing to the fore, and it's an issue that's currently being litigated across the country, is what role, if any, do public schools have in regulating speech that occurs off campus? So on one end of the spectrum, there appears to be sort of pretty broad agreement that general political opinions that have no effect on school are off limits for schools to touch. On the other end of the spectrum is speech or conduct that occurs off campus that nevertheless has a very, very strong nexus to school. So I think one of the examples, either in the Mahanoy opinion or that was raised in the oral argument, was students cheating on tests away from school. Sure, you might not actually be at school, but are we really going to say that that doesn't have enough of a nexus to the school, where if a school finds out that you're cheating on your homework, that they can't suspend you? So that's sort of the general framework that we're working with right now in Mahanoy. And the reason it's important, and this, and the majority, Justice Breyer's majority opinion in Mahanoy got right to the heart of this issue, is that if you allow public schools to have the same degree of control over speech out of school as they do in school, all of a sudden you're turning public school administrators into essentially 24/7 speech police and board of censorship over public school student speech. And that's simply not acceptable.
Either the other of you would touch on Mahanoy at all, implications for your cases?
I'll just say it doesn't, because of the reason Connor explained, it really doesn't affect ours because ours was on campus and it is a different standard. I mean, obviously they have different interests in regulating that speech, but I do think it's important because social media is so prevalent that, you know, obviously that off-campus speech can have the same effect that the schools are saying they have a right to regulate speech here, which is somebody doesn't like your speech. And so I think, you know, the fact that they say, well, LM can say there's only two genders on social media and he can wear the shirt to school, but he just can't wear it in school, like those same effects are there. And so I think it really undermines the fact that they can say this outside of school. I think it undermines their interest to say that these kids aren't going to be able to get an education because they know that their classmates hold these different viewpoints and somehow they can't learn next to somebody who holds a different opinion on a different topic.
So we have a question here, and also, so go ahead, Connor.
Yeah, and Casey, one thing I would add, and actually this gets to the previous question as well, is it's very easy to forget that minors have their own First Amendment rights. We know that most recently from the Brown case from the Supreme Court that involved minors purchasing video games. So minors are American citizens with constitutional rights just like everyone else. They have every right to go to a park and circulate a petition or go door-to-door campaigning for the candidate of their choice. And so this idea that the government, that the state can come in and start telling them, you shall not have these thoughts, you shall not say these things, is very, very chilling from a free speech perspective.
We have a quick question here. Just an informational question. Someone was asking if there are First Amendment friendly organizations that do trainings for school administrators or faculty. So I will let any of you who want to do an ad, feel free to answer.
I believe FIRE does, but I'm only about 80% sure of it. But if you email, I can give you 100% certain answer.
I'll say that as a result of a few settlements we've had in suing these schools, they've agreed to and actually had their professors and others undergo First Amendment training as a result of that. And so part of it is, you know, we have done that, but we would love to do it. I think it's really important to do it. I don't know how many I think the issue is school administrators have to be open to and welcome organizations that actually want to train on it. But I'm not aware of any that regularly do it, or that there's a large number of schools that actually bring in organizations like ourselves to train on it.
So we also had the sort of originalism related question. So we had someone ask about sort of history and tradition. Connor, I know you mentioned that in your case that question sort of came up. How do we think about originalism and free speech rights in the context of an entity that basically did not exist when the First Amendment was written, in the sense of sort of public schools as we understand them today. So I'm curious for your the thoughts of any of the three of you on sort of how originalism works in this particular area.
Sure. So originalism is kind of a messy fit for K through 12 speech, both for the reasons that Casey mentioned and because, you know, Tinker very much changed the landscape. Now, the original idea that that school administrators and teachers should have total and complete authority, think sort of the Trunchbull in the book and movie Matilda, that they should have complete authority over everyone. That was the opinion that was advanced in Justice Black's solo dissent in Tinker, and it was the opinion that Justice Thomas advanced in his solo dissent in Mahanoy, the idea that essentially K through 12 students don't have First Amendment rights and you have whatever rights your teacher or principal says you have, and then you should be good little boys and girls and do as they say. That hasn't been the law for 50 years because more than 50 years because of Tinker. And what Tinker said is that schools exist not just to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. Schools exist to prepare the next generation of American citizens. And part of that is being exposed to different ideas, hearing ideas and political expression that might not align with what you hear at home and with your friends. And I think there's been a very, I would say, settled consensus since Tinker. I haven't seen much momentum for resuscitating Justice Black's Tinker dissent in terms of trying to turn back the clock and junk Tinker.
Tyson, Caleb, either one of you got a great Federalist Papers quote for us or something that shines light on this? It is tricky, obviously, on one level, one degree of generality. I think the originalism question is always challenging in these issues where there's not an obvious sort of parallel at the in the founding era. And the question basically is, well, on what level of generality are you applying originalism? Right. If the question is, free speech rights of free speech rights generally, free speech rights of kids, free speech rights in a educational context, it can be challenging trying to figure out how to apply this given the lack of sort of good guidance, at least as far as I know. But maybe that's an opportunity for someone listening who will provide us with the Law Review article that will be just in time for one or more cert petitions on this call. Okay, if we have other questions, then feel free to drop them in. How do the government speech cases interface with these cases? And maybe we've already sort of addressed that to some degree, given the conversation we had earlier before about the curriculum choices and how that works. We'll go to this question: schools and dress codes. I presumably none of the three cases that we have, well, actually, especially Tyson's case and Connor's case, neither one of them, the school didn't have a clear dress code that applied. If it had a dress code, would that have changed the outcome of the cases?
Well, I mean, I'll weigh in. It had a dress. You know, it had a dress code policy just prohibiting stuff. But if a school wants to say every student has to wear a white shirt and khaki pants or a khaki skirt, something like that, I think a school could do that. I think that, if a school wanted to have a straight prohibition on certain things like that, they probably could. The problem is most of them don't. They don't want that because I think that, parents, these are, individual school boards, and the community kind of determines what they want. And I don't think most people have voted for that. But yeah, I mean, I don't think in my mind, there is no, there would be, the First Amendment wouldn't prohibit a policy, which is generally neutral across the board, that just says, hey, here's what you have to wear every day. I don't know if Connor and Caleb have a different opinion, but that's my take.
Yeah, I might quibble with that a little bit, but I think sort of the general contours of Tyson's description of the law are accurate. So the dress code actually is front and center in our Let's Go Brandon case. The district court affirmed the school district's reliance on the dress code's ban against, quote, profanity as a basis to ban the Let's Go Brandon hoodies. Now, a separate part of our lawsuit challenged a dress code provision that barred attire which, quote, calls undue attention to oneself. We challenged that as violating the First Amendment, as well as it being vague and overbroad. And the school district repealed that during litigation. But oftentimes, when you see the censorship of the sort that's happening in the cases that y'all have heard about today, it's being done under the guise of a dress code.
And I don't have anything to add on dress codes, but before you got to that question, Casey, you're mentioning the question on government speech, and I don't think that is implicated at all in our case. We're not challenging whether the school could have or necessarily even should have been teaching Black Lives Matter to first graders. I think personally, I don't think that was appropriate, but that's not really a part of a case. But I think what is definitely shown through the school creating that environment of teaching Black Lives Matter and then punishing BB for including the phrase any life is that that was pretty much very clear viewpoint discrimination, in my opinion. There's really no explanation for punishing her other than, well, I mean, the principal was pretty clear when he said it was racist and inappropriate to include that. And so I think that will definitely be part of the appeal to some extent.
And Caleb, am I correct to understand that the student has already served her time at this point?
Yes, that happened. She is now 10 or 11, but there was a question in the chat about other families supporting them. And I would say there were some families offering some quiet support, but eventually things got so bad because of the one-sided depiction of this amongst the school and basically the administration, you know, pushing back against the family's complaints, that things kind of devolved to a degree of harassment for the family that they wound up moving across the country and they're in Florida now. So it's what was the not just what happened at the school specifically was deeply troubling, but some of the community's reaction to it and just assuming that this innocent child trying to be inclusive was somehow a secret racist was quite alarming.
And I'll just add on that, Casey, you know, to think about this, it happened in a similar thing in LM's case where the school is saying by telling somebody else that their viewpoint on gender identity is wrong, you're engaged in speech that is going to be so harmful they can't learn. But in our case, the school denounced LM's speech and said it was so horrible that he couldn't even be at school and that it was this, you know, hateful speech. And they don't even take into account, you know, the impact that a school denouncing that speech would be on the student who they disagreed with. So I think many times the school censorship does, you know, much the same kind of harm or damage that they're claiming the original speech did.
Well, thank you all very much. We could keep answering questions. There are a lot of great questions in the Q&A, but we are out of time. So I'll welcome back Shayla to close us out.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate our panel carving out a section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.